have close cooperation with British intelligence, the Army intelligence?
Oh, yes. We had all the reports that came through, the intelligence reports, from the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. Mm-hmm. I should say the Navy first. All came through me, and then gave any of that information on to the police or to the civil authorities, and any of their information came through us. That's why my card index really was pretty terrific.
Yeah, you were sort of the central point for almost all the service.
For everything like this.
It must have been awfully difficult having to go through all this mound of information.
Yes, it was. It was terrific.
Because you're doing what they now call analysis, intelligence analysis,
yeah.
And they usually have...
computers, and goodness knows what, but they didn't.
Hundreds of people.
I know. No, it was just me.
Yes.
Which was quite a business.
Oh, okay.
The girls, I used to get to fill in some of the things afterwards, but some of them learned how to do ciphering.
Mm-hmm.
But you weren't supposed to unless you were sort of absolutely...
Okay. Well, how much trust did you put in your Chinese clerks?
Well, they didn't do anything except for Chinese people.
Yeah.
People, coolies and contractors that were taken on to do things in the dockyard and things like that. They had cards all for them. They didn't see any of our stuff at all.
So you did your own typing, anything that...
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And burning up all the papers every night.
Yeah.
Sometimes you send one of the girls to... It was awfully hot to go and sit... stand on top of a roof and burn all the carbon papers, any bits of papers that you used that day,
because
you couldn't keep them.
You had to keep poking in the fire to make sure everything got burned.
Well, you got the peon to do that.
Yeah, but you
had
to
there. Stand there and watch in case they were taking some and then selling them off to somebody else, which I don't think they would because they were nice heads.
Mm-hmm. But there were many examples of either Malays or Tamils?
Tamils.
Tamils. Actually collaborating with the Japanese.
Oh, yes, later on. Not so much the Malays, I think, because they were... the Malays are a very pleasant people.
Mm-hmm.
They are very lazy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know much and they don't care much. They just like it for their own selves. And they're very sweet, but you couldn't get them to ever run a government or anything, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
That's why all the ones in Malaya now are all Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Would they be ambivalent towards who was their master, be it British or Japanese?
Oh yes, very much so. Because the Japs would, though they didn't approve of that at all.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of them during the war, people who were taken prisoner, they said their own servants came and sort of got things to them and helped them as much as they could in that way. So?
Can I also ask something else?
Mm-hmm.
Had you and your mother did you try to escape before?
No.
You didn't, did you?
No, because I thought I was, essential.
Yeah.
I thought my card index would be frightfully important when we started going back, so if we could nail people all along the way that were
actually
doing things.
And you, and your mother wouldn't allow...
She wouldn't go without me.
No, you were that close.
Yes, and also I felt that as a lot of the ships were being bombed on the way out, that at least
if
she was with me,
then
I could see she was all right.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So that was what was happening really back then. Now, can I go on from here like this?
Yes, please.
To begin with, we found we were in the Messagerie Maritime Félix Roussel, usually carrying about 50 white and possibly 200 coolie passengers, but now with over 2,000. Instead of the P&O ship, which had been bombed and sunk in the harbour, our P&O tickets were marked A, or top deck cabins. But in the messagerie terms, this was a dimly lit hold, three decks below third or coolie class, with foul bilge water swishing from side to side and shared by 150 people. The air was fetid with the stench of decay and the sour smell of unwashed previous occupants and bad drains. By this time, we were not only hungry. I'd had nothing since breakfast except water, but parched with thirst. But it was thought too hazardous to try and drink the dark brown water which gushed erratically from the only tap. I went up the main deck to see if I could change our accommodation and to get some water, but the very Vichy crew, possibly tired, were unnecessarily surly and uncooperative. I found a tap from which I drank copiously of the tepid but at least colourless water and scrounged with difficulty a battered enamel mug which I filled for my mother. I returned through the third class, where our nearest facilities, loos and wash basins, baths from much further away, were located. During my absence, some hammocks had been strung up in the centre aisle. I found them uncomfortable and tricky to get in and out of, but they were quite impossible for my poor darling. She had to sleep on one of the many long tables in which luggage was piled to keep it off the wet deck. Luckily, I'd packed our oyster-colored camel hair coats, rolled in a blanket with a cushion, and even though they were better than nothing, they didn't make much of a mattress for her. We sailed around midnight and were escorted, I was told, by HMS Exeter, who won worldwide fame during the sinking of the German pocket battleship Admiral Graf Spee. We were specially grieved later to hear of her loss during the Java Sea battle. Her captain, F.S. Hookie Bell, had been in Singapore for some time, commanding HMS Sultan, a stone ship. The first time I'd heard him on the telephone, it seemed to amuse him when I said I felt I was talking to history. They were a charming couple, and his most attractive wife looked very like Beatrice Lilly. Eventually, I drifted into a fitful sleep. Suddenly woke to see several enormous rats running along the ledge circling the hold. I was petrified, but unwilling to wake anybody to add another horror to what had already proved to be a living nightmare. Our first meal, a weak coffee, for which we were issued battered enamel mugs, a slice of sour bread, and an enamel bowl of soupish stew served from a large bucket, became the pattern of our meals, our three meals a day. They were served on the other side of the hold on their tables made of what looked like driftwood, with huge cracks through which revolting large cockroaches would lurk and peer at us in the hope of a tidbit. My mother and I usually managed to get a spoon between us, but there would only be a knife down the side of the table. The food was just eatable, though scant, but we yearned for fresh fruit. The nearest we got to it, when it was a dollop of raspberry jam, was put on the side of each bowl, but although by the time we got hold of a knife, it had slipped into the stew, it was considered a real treat. After breakfast, we went up three metal greasy ladders through the normal third class, where many family groups of Chinese, each with the inevitable potty, shared a large room, and then up two stairways to the main deck. It was a joy to breathe fresh air, but within a few minutes there was an air raid and we were told to go below. Throughout the day there were numerous raids, but there was more to come. The next time we returned off deck it was because of a mutiny. Apparently when the P&O ship was sunk, her crew, very tough Liverpool Irish, found cases of booze on the docks, became dead drunk, and only came to on the Felix Roussel. They were befuddled, and I hope had horrendous hangovers. But when they discovered the vast majority of women aboard, they decided to take over the ship. However, we were lucky to have 8 or 10 seamen off HMS Prince of Wales under the command of an elderly Royal Naval Reserve officer. They gradually rounded up the mutineers and put them in irons for the rest of the voyage on a lower cargo deck.
Do you recall the officer's name?
No, never knew it. He was about 70.
Really?
And he sat up in a chair the whole time. I don't think he ever left. Well, he had to leave it because he went off occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
But he sat there and sort of catnapped occasionally, but he was there in the middle of everything the whole time, which was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
He was a dear old thing, but I haven't seen what his name was. I don't think anybody knew.
Were there any examples of the mutineers before or perhaps afterwards taking advantage of any of the women on board?
They tried.
Did they?
Some of the women even thought it was a good idea.
You had that?
I must say we had very peculiar people. That made it even more difficult.
For your mother and you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
During the next few days, the air raids continued, and on one occasion, our single Bofors gun, manned by the Navy men, was believed to have downed a plane. Being bombed on land is no picnic, but at sea one feels more vulnerable. And even though no direct hits were scored, it was a nerve-wracking business, and we were thankful when the raids came to an end. Then, on the morning of Friday the 13th, there was a submarine scare. We'd all been issued life jackets to be carried at all times, and assigned to specific rafts, as the lifeboats had all been shattered by shrapnel. We were told that after a torpedo attack, all sharks in the vicinity would be stunned for at least an hour, This was supposed to be comforting, but the idea of hanging onto a raft and then being attacked by sharks didn't have much appeal. We were also told to keep all visits to our cabin, inevitable for meals and dressing, to a minimum, and as brief as possible, for if a torpedo struck, there wouldn't have been a chance of getting up on deck or a hope of rescue. Bathing was a problem to begin with, as it was not unusual to find a pile of excrement where the bath had been used instead of a loo. Then most of the plugs had disappeared, so one's heel had to stop the water from escaping, and also each tap had to be held or the flow of water automatically shut off. Small basin of fresh water per person was available for half an hour from 5 a.m. to rinse off the seawater and also to do any necessary laundry. The ship, meanwhile, continued to zigzag almost to the coast of Africa. Although after Malaya, we didn't get even a glimpse of land until we reached Bombay on March the 4th. Throughout the voyage, there had been a complete blackout of news, so the fall of Singapore on the 15th of February was a tremendous shock, especially to those who'd left husbands or family behind. The uncertainty of their fate added to their already overburdened emotions. In the midst of their frantic grief, it was impossible to voice any concern over our purely material losses. The authorities in Bombay did a remarkable job of arranging suitable accommodation for everyone before we could disembark, but it was terribly frustrating to be kept aboard until the morning, when we arrived was the 1st of March, until the morning of the 4th of March, with the possibility of real baths, ice water and fresh fruit being so near, but yet so unobtainable. I was up as usual before 5, feeling an ineffectual bath was better than nothing, when I was told my mother was ill. I rushed up on deck to find my poor darling was throwing up. I knew she was completely exhausted after bearing with great courage a superabundance of horrors. I was terrified she might have picked up a bug and that she would be taken off to some ghastly quarantine station. Kind woman suggested she could rest in her cabin. In the space in our gas mask, haversacks, I'd put some glucose D and an extra supply of her medicines and a large tube of sunburn cream in case we'd been stranded at sea, and a small flask of brandy. I fled downstairs to glucose D and brandy. They seemed to help, although she threw up less violently. Meanwhile, I rushed up and down, keeping an eye on her at the same time, trying to dress, collect and pack our belongings. Eventually, I got her washed and dressed, and although loaded up with our possessions, managed to help her down the gangway. It was a most welcome end to a traumatic, but I suppose to some extent successful voyage, in which we had arrived. A nice St. John's ambulance worker appeared with a wheelchair and said she would take care of my mother. I asked the doses of glucose and brandy be renewed as necessary and that she keep in touch with me. In the meantime, I had to stand in endless queues under both names of Crawford and Ingram for passports and customs, where I was asked, had I brought a grand piano, a refrigerator, antiques, or precious jewelry? The Chinese had all been listed not under their first or surname, but under the second given name, which added to the general confusion.
Why was that then?
Well, they thought that was the last name.
No? Yes.
Smith, John, Henry.
Yes.
And they took Henry as the surname.
Mm-hmm.
Chow Eng Sung.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do Chow, it was the Sung they put it under. I was terribly glad and relieved to see my suite had slightly recovered and even taken tea and toast. In the currency queue, I stood behind a hostess from one of the worlds. These, it does say beforehand, they were obviously rather well-paid prostitutes who went to the worlds that were sort of like tubby places.
Oh, I guess, yeah.
Who changed several thousand dollars into silver rupees, either biting or clinking each one on the counter to be sure it was genuine.
Mm-hmm.
It was now after 2 o'clock, and in my last queue, I was dismayed, because I don't usually give way, and definitely not in public, to find the tears of utter exhaustion pouring down my cheeks. A kind official took me into his office and completed whatever forms were necessary. Soon after, the present couple, a gunner major and his wife, who were to be our hosts, arrived and drove us to their nice modern flat. was a joy indeed. After copious glasses of iced water, to have tea and wafer cut bread and butter. Then to soak in a succession of warm baths and to enjoy to the full Rupert Brooke's The Venison of Hot Water. Our hosts very thoughtfully suggested that we should have an early dinner in our room. We were hungry, and the roast chicken, peas and potatoes, followed by fresh fruit salad, all served on real china instead of enamel bowls, really hit the spot.
Were you able to handle it after a month?
Yes. It wasn't very much, but we did. Then there was the bliss of sleeping in a bed with sheets, and we felt that our nightmare was over. Until early next morning, when we were awakened by the shriek of sirens, but relieved to learn that it was the usual Saturday practice and not the real thing. On Monday, we went to Grindley's, our bank, who arranged for berths on Tuesday's Frontier Mail and accommodation in Delhi. But they must have forgotten our present plight and made reservations, as they had in more affluent days, at the Cecil Hotel in Old Delhi. The Cecil was old-fashioned and mainly residential, and was set in a huge garden with well-tended lawns, flowering shrubs and trees, and large borders massed with flowers. We arrived when the foyer was filled with people going into dinner, the women in evening dresses, the men either in uniform or dinner jackets. We were tired, felt bedraggled, and must have looked out of place with motley collection of luggage, rope-tied bundles, tin hats and gas masks, but the owner, Miss Hotz, smilingly greeted us and led us to a magnificent suite. We said we were sure it was much too expensive, but she said, don't worry about it. She left to order dinner to be served in our sitting room, and returned shortly with a large silver bowl filled with glorious red roses. I shall never forget her kindness. Many years ago, her mother, Mrs. Hotz, had been left a young widow with a family and no money. She took lodgers into her home and soon was so popular that she had to rent the bungalows on either side. In time, she bought a hotel, then another and another, and on her death, her daughter ran the one in Lahore, and then the Cecil. My mother remembers that Miss Hotz always stayed up until the last train so that she could personally greet arrivals and in winter give them a cup of hot soup. We had come to Delhi hoping to see that Robin, Harold Rowntree, a senior medical officer married to a first cousin of my mother's, would help me to get a job, but were disappointed and sad to hear that he'd recently gone home on sick leave. However, my mother rang up an old friend of ours and a colleague of my stepfather's, Sir Kenneth Mitchell, I think he'd been undersecretary to him at one time, who insisted that we stay with him and his daughter Maxine in New Delhi. When we told Miss Hotz we were leaving, she said, it must be an answer to prayers. I have a brigadier and seven officers waiting that I can put into your suite. It was a joy to relax among old friends, with no fear of imminent danger. The house was lovely, with a beautiful garden and masses of specially imported MacReady's roses and borders ablaze with colour. Although Kenneth, as Director General of Transport, had to award priorities for all air, land and sea movements in Delhi, in India, he used to bicycle, even in the hottest weather, to the Secretariat a good 2 miles away in order to set an example of saving petrol. They had two dachshunds who were death on all cats until one evening, when they were lying, stretched out in front of the fireplace, and as my heart went into my mouth, a tiny 9 weeks-old Siamese kitten stalked into the room. Went straight up to them, spat at one and then at the other, sat down in between them, and completely unconcerned, started to wash herself. From that moment, she took command of the household and had no trouble with the dogs. We were touched when Mahbub, an old Kit Magar, appeared one afternoon from Old Delhi, which is 9 miles away, to present his four tall, good-looking sons and to tell us the sad news that Lalu was dead. One day, Maxine took her shopping, though in our case it was just looking, in Leela Rong's, whose similar branch I knew well. We were surprised when an assistant rushed up to greet us as we bought gorgeous materials from him in Singapore and were amused to hear that he'd comfortably flown out. Later on, when we returned to Delhi and good materials were scarce, I would get surreptitious phone calls. Mrs. Hundumal, I have put aside some materials for you and Mem Saab to see. I would dash in after work, and as he knew what colours and types of things we liked, I would gratefully buy dress links for both of us before they were snatched up. Soon after our arrival, I got in touch with the director of the Intelligence Bureau and gave him a letter from the Singapore Inspector General of Police. He, knowing that the Ministry of Economic Warfare was endeavouring to increase its staff, suggested to Colin McKenzie, the Director General, that I might suit. Do you mind if I go? I'll be back. I might drink. The whole thing is a bit of a problem.
Okay, we're back.
Suggested to Colin McKenzie, the Director General, that I might suit. Colin was a most remarkable man who, when a very young subaltern, lost a leg in France only weeks before the 1918 armistice. As a career in the army was no longer possible, he turned to business and eventually became a director of J.B. Coates. He had a magnificent brain and incredible powers of concentration. I'm sure that Churchill's remark that Englishmen in a crisis fly into a calm applied to him. He was given a secret commission as a second lieutenant in his old regiment, the Scots Guards, that had the precedence of a major general, Viceroy's priority, and direct access to the Chief of Staff's committee. His charming wife, Pin, worked in the office doing codes and ciphers, and their baby daughter was sent with her nanny to spend the rest of the war in Scotland. Our peaceful interlude ended. We went to Meer at 40 miles from Delhi on the 1st of April 1942, and on the 1st of April 1942, I became a member of the Ministry of Economic Warfare.
May I ask you what precisely that was a euphemism for, or was it a euphemism?
It was, and I'll tell you a little later on here.
Okay, I'll wait for it.
If I may.
Sure.
The Ministry of Economic Warfare was a part of Secret Operation Executive, SOE. Its main function was to cause alarm, despondency, and disruption to the enemy, war effort, in all the territories overrun by the Japanese, and to this end it set up commando training schools for those taking part in operations behind the enemy lines. In The Man Called Intrepid, we were called the Baker Street Irregulars. My first day...
May I ask you, I hate to interrupt, but were you all, did you know, or did you think of yourselves, and did you humorously call yourselves the Baker Street Irregulars?
We didn't know about that at all.
That was the name that came
that
later.
That came, we didn't know, we didn't start it. It was Intrepid who called us that.
Oh, did he?
Not, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Baker Street was our code name for the office in London.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and did you know of Stevenson and his work?
No, didn't know anything about it at all.
No,
see,
no.
We only did our part of the world, huh? We didn't know anything about it here. That's why I was so interested in reading it,
mm-hmm.
because I hadn't heard any of the bits that
came
in here.
It tied it all together.
Yes,
it
did. My first day, just before 8 p.m., when I was ready to leave, I was given a check for a month's pay. The voyage was most welcome. We needed bedding and mosquito nets. I couldn't help wondering if it was a joke, because it was the 1st of April. As I'd never before been paid in advance. However, after a few months, this routine was altered, and if I hadn't been careful, it would have been tricky to wait 2 months for the next paycheck. One afternoon, a short time later, with less than an hour's notice, I was transferred temporarily to help in our office in GHQ New Delhi. I was met at the station by a pleasant officer, whose name I don't remember, from Chile, who was very proud of the fact that his riding breeches and uniform from the First World War still fitted. He said accommodation had been reserved for us at Maiden's Hotel in Old Delhi. Maiden's, though larger and more modern, didn't have the ambiance and charm of the Cecil. The sun had been blazing into my bedroom on the top floor of the newest wing, turning it into an oven. After unpacking and a bath, I went down to meet my confrère for a very welcome long tinkling drink in the large shadowy veranda next to the dining room, where recently watered tubs of palms and flowering plants gave off a deliciously earthy aroma. Each morning, after breakfast, a bus would collect a general or two, various senior officers, and me, and take us to GHQ. Then at 1 o'clock, we were driven to and from the Imperial, an associate hotel, for lunch, and finally in the evening returned to Maiden's. I was somewhat amused when our small table in the dining room was gradually enlarged to accommodate 6 to 8 officers who apparently wanted to join us, one of whom was Major Ord C. Wingate. For some weeks, I saw him daily at meals, and he also spent a lot of time in our office whilst waiting for his report on long-range penetration groups, which had proved to be so successful in Abyssinia and Somalia, to be read and acted upon by the Commander-in-Chief. It must have been particularly frustrating for him, as at that time, both Sir Archibald Wavell, later Field Marshal Earl Wavell, Viceroy of India, and Sir Claude Auchinleck, the Auk, were appointed and reappointed Commander-in-Chief in such quick succession that a decision on his report was delayed. Although he was a man of great vision, audacity, dedication and determination, he was also didactic, self-opinionated, and lacking in the magic charm of Lawrence of Arabia, a distant cousin, whose fame he hoped to emulate. Once at lunch, after eating curry, he finished the accompanying bowl of raw onions, which he considered a cure for all ills, with his raspberry ice. I remember thinking, what a man. After my temporary sojourn in Delhi, I never saw him again, but was twice briefly involved in his affairs. Once when I contacted Wilkinson's, the swordmakers, to make strong-tempered steel dars, curved saber-like weapons capable of slashing through the thickest jungle, and, if necessary, of silently and satisfactorily dispatching an enemy. Then, after my return to Meerut from Bombay, late one afternoon, in June or July 1943, I and two other intelligence officers were asked to type this top-secret report with a mass of diagrams of Brigadier Wingate's first and very successful Chindit operation, as at that time he'd no office staff. It was an exciting assignment, particularly knowing him, as the top copy was for Churchill. And of the seven onion skins, one was for Pug Ismay, General Sir Hastings Ismay, afterwards Baron Ismay of the Chiefs of Staff Committee, another for the Viceroy, and other VIPs. As everything had to be perfect, each page was checked and rechecked, as were the mass of diagrams, and it was well after midnight before it was all finished. I knew I was far too tense to go to sleep immediately, so I decided to accompany the officer taking the dispatches to the airport at Delhi, where the Liberator was standing by to fly them to London. It was a glorious night, and the stars shimmered in the deep blue, almost cloudless sky. The Liberator rose, surely with Rupert Brooke's The Unpassioned Beauty of a Great Machine, and we watched until the roar of its four engines died away, and it looked like an enormous dark moth flying into the pale lemony lightning of the horizon and the first wispy rays of dawn. I've often wondered how out of a seemingly cloudless sky, both dawn and sunset, clouds always appear on the horizon, adding a special enchantment to the scene. In Closing the Ring, Churchill said Wingate was a man of genius, and that the expression, the Clive of Burma, had gained currency, and that at his untimely death, that a bright flame was extinguished.
May I ask you something sort of incongruous with the subject matter, but you mentioned a quote by Churchill and you applied it to, what was it now again? In the Calm.
The Calm, yes.
Russian, where did you find that?
Oh, I found it in one of his books, I think.
One of the World War II histories?
I don't know if it was in that. I've read practically all of Churchill.
Mm-hmm. I've read
and it's
too,
in one of, it, I just thought that was perfectly lovely.
Mm-hmm. But, going back to your trip on the P&O.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't P&O, it was Messager Maritime.
Oh, right, it was the Vichy ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right, you had picked up some P&O people.
I'm sure the Churchill's remark that Englishmen in a crisis fly into a calm applied for him.
That's very nice, I like that.
I like that, I thought that was fun.
Did you know you were going to India?
No, we didn't know where we were going. We were frankly surprised to arrive there.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know at all where we were.
Mm-hmm. And those on board, were they mainly whites, or were there a great many Chinese?
Most of the white people had left.
Mm-hmm.
There were, I suppose, several hundred of them, but thousands of Chinese, and they had their males with them quite often,
right.
Whereas none of our men were allowed to come.
Were there any senior officers on board?
No, there were just those seamen off the Prince of Wales.
Off the Prince of
Mm-hmm. And the one RNV officer who I think was only a lieutenant, he might have been lieutenant commander.
Yeah, he was 70.
Oh, he was well on. I mean, he was very, I think he was. Everybody said he was absolutely fantastic. And he sat in this rather comfortable chair, facing all the things. He could see the decks there, and he was on that thing. And he occasionally would just sort of go, oh, why is he be there the whole time?
And day and night. And he's the undisputed ruler of the...
Oh, yes, absolutely so. Mm-hmm.
And would the 8 naval ratings which were on board with him, they would more or less gravitate towards him, or did they... And
oh, no, well, there were always some of them there, I think, and the others were probably, A, looking after the Bofors gun, and B, doing anything, you know.
Were there any particular scares of submarine, actual submarine scares?
Well, there was that one on the Friday the 13th, which was rather terrible. Otherwise, you don't usually know about the submarine until it's actually hit you. Mm-hmm. We weren't hit.
And you were unescorted as well, weren't you?
After the first day, I think,
when
the Exeter left us. Mm-hmm. So?
Mm-hmm. We're getting very near the end of the tape. Could I possibly turn over and then we can
Yes, do.
Finish
yes,
it
yes.
Like
there you are, because I've got quite a lot more to do.
Okay.